Good afternoon and welcome to this National Flashpoint special teach-in on the threat of war against Iraq and the U.S. and world resistance to it. I'm Dennis Bernstein, host of Flashpoint's daily news magazine on Pacifica Radio in California and Texas. Stay tuned. You are listening to Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We are coming to you live from KPFA in Berkeley, California. And as I said, this is a National Flashpoint special teach-in on the threat of war against Iraq and the U.S. and world resistance to it. And boy, that resistance is big time. And of course, you can hear we have a live studio, small studio audience here. Today, the people of the world spoke. And they said no to a war for oil. They said yes to inspections and no to invasions. Millions of people from Berlin to Bangkok and Paris to Sao Paulo said no. And from one end of these United States to the other, even as we speak, Americans are saying no to Washington's oil barons and to the endless wars. Yesterday at the United Nations, Secretary of State General Colin Powell was greeted with disbelief and deep resistance. The leaders of the world also said no to war and yes to disarmament through inspections. French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin was greeted by an unprecedented applause when he declared that the UN should be used as a tool for peace and not a tool for war. Today on this National Flashpoint special teach-in against the war, we will examine the myths and the realities of Washington's rush to war, the attacks on civil liberties and civil rights since 9/11, the failure of the mainstream media to cover this, and we'll be hearing reports from around the country and around the world. In one moment, we'll be joined by Diana Johnstone in Paris, Andreas Sumach in Germany, and in the studio by Joel Bainan from Stanford University and Arab journalist Lamis Andoni. But first, we go to Baghdad and Jeremy Scahill. We spoke to Jeremy just before airtime about the Iraqi people's response to yesterday's UN actions and to the real possibilities that the U.S. will ignore the rest of the world and unleash a massive bombing attack against them.
This is Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad, where people are expressing cautious optimism about the report from Hans Blix and Mohammed Al-Baradei at the UN Security Council yesterday. Iraq is saying that it shows clearly that they are cooperating with the UN weapons inspections process. They say that they want this process to continue and that they are acting in good faith, but they also have paid very close attention to the statement of Colin Powell yesterday after the Security Council meetings, in which he basically said that the Security Council is going to have to face what he called Iraqi noncompliance. No one here has any illusions about the fact that war has not been averted. In fact, most people clearly continue to believe that war is going to come, and it's going to come in the very near future. People continue to prepare themselves for that reality. Now, as people began to go through some of what was said and done yesterday at the UN Security Council, there were very large demonstrations today in Baghdad, tens of thousands of Iraqis taking to multiple parts of the city today, marching and chanting slogans in support of the Iraqi president, Saddam Hussein, some of them brandishing Kalashnikov rifles, clear message from Iraq that this is an armed population. The official line is that the people are going to resist a U.S. invasion, but to be quite frank about it, Dennis, many, many people are very afraid, and I think that the primary fear right now that people have is for their children. And so many people are talking about leaving Baghdad and other urban areas and going to more rural areas of Iraq. But again, these demonstrations were very, very large. They were very tightly secured. One has to remember that these recent reports that the United States has inserted U.S. special forces into Iraq, I think that that, to some degree, has increased the tensions here. I think that there are fears of possible sabotage, not just in Baghdad, but in other areas around Iraq. Now, while the Iraqis were demonstrating in areas throughout the city, in a separate action, a group of about 200 international activists marched through the streets of Baghdad They marched past offices of the United Nations, where they processed to the Al-Rashid Bridge in downtown Baghdad at 12 noon local time. They had a moment of silence for 1 minute. They're asking people to stop what they're doing for 1 minute every day at noon to stop the war. That was the call that came from the activists today to activists around the world every day at noon. Stop for 1 minute to stop the war. Now, the activists are not just American and not just from Voices in the Wilderness or the Iraq Peace Team. You had everyone from a caravan of people came from the Balkans, from Bulgaria, Slovenia, as well as from Poland. You also had Japanese drummers and dancers from Okinawa, Japan, who chanted through the streets of Baghdad today. You had activists who came from Italy, from Spain, from all across the globe. Activists are now beginning to slowly pour into Baghdad. Some of them say that they are here to stand with ordinary Iraqi people. Others say that they intend to serve as human shields and to spread out at sites like electrical facilities, water treatment facilities, and other civilian infrastructure in the country to protect them against U.S. bombs. But overwhelmingly, what you're hearing from the activists here is that they want to try to prevent a war. There is very little fatalism among the activists, particularly those that have just arrived. They say that they are here to stop a war, Dennis.
That's the voice of Jeremy Scahill. He is speaking to us live from the ground in Baghdad on this National Pacifica anti-war teach-in. And we are talking about myths and realities of this war. Jeremy Scahill, as you know, Colin Powell met stark silence and deep resistance at the United Nations. I'm wondering, is there a sense of that? Do the Iraqi people know that the rest of the world is rising up in support of them and against war?
Absolutely, Dennis. In fact, I was just watching on local television here, not just footage of the demonstrations today, the Iraqi demonstration, the international demonstration here in Baghdad, but also footage is beginning to come in from Rome, where we understand that a million plus people have been in the streets, as well as in London. Reports of a million plus people. The Iraqis are aware of this. They know that the world is on the side of the Iraqi people in saying that this war is something that's cooked up by the oligarchy in Washington, that this isn't about human rights, this isn't about democracy, this isn't about freedom of speech, press, or religion, that what this really is about is U.S. oil interests. The Iraqis know that, but I also have to say, Dennis, that I think that while people are encouraged by seeing that, the general attitude on the ground here remains one of pessimism and, in some cases, utter panic. I think people are tremendously afraid of what lies ahead of them. People are primarily concerned with their children, as I said. They're concerned with the idea that they have faced war before. One woman told us, I have tasted war before, we have tasted war before, and we don't like what it tastes like. And so they know of the reports of 3,000 missiles hitting Baghdad in the opening days of this war that the U.S. wants to wage against the people of Iraq. Quite frankly, they're tired, Dennis. They are very tired people. They are exhausted. They have been through the Iran-Iraq War, where the U.S. had its dirty hand all over the place. They've been through the Gulf War, where the United States killed upwards of 200,000 Iraqis. And they have been through 12 years of the most harsh economic sanctions in history. And people simply want it to end. They are saying that they can't take it anymore.
Finally, Jeremy, you've been in the country for a number of months over the last year. You broke the story of Secretary of Rumsfeld, Secretary of War, and his meetings with Saddam Hussein and other Iraqi officials. Would you please remind people of the contradictions between what the Americans are saying now and what these war makers were doing in the 80s?
This administration that's in Washington contains several people who have a track record of not caring at all about the use of non-conventional weapons if they're used against the quote-unquote right people. And Donald Rumsfeld is chief among them. This is a man who was in Baghdad in 1983 and 1984 when the U.S. government and the United Nations were stating clearly that Iraq was using chemical weapons against Iranian troops in the war, in the Iran-Iraq war. He said nothing. He instead worked to bring Saddam Hussein into America's fold. He worked to normalize relations for the United States. This is a man who cannot be trusted, particularly on issues of weapons of mass destruction. He has shown his position on it, and that is that if they're used against the right people, that it's perfectly acceptable to Washington. And so as people listen to people like Donald Rumsfeld and Colin Powell, who used non-conventional weapons in the form of depleted uranium against the people of Iraq during the 1991 Gulf Massacre, these are not people that have credibility when it comes to those issues. They simply should not be believed. They have a track record of lying and a track record of ultimately supporting the use of these weapons.
And a personal note, we have talked earlier about what you will do and other reporters will do if the bombs start falling. Do you have plans to take care of yourself? And how will this unfold if that occurs?
The last time I talked to you, I told you that we were having this discussion on which side of the river, of the Tigris River, to be on, because what we're very afraid of is being cut off from the ability to get access to particularly telephone lines to get reports out of this country. One of the things that, on a personal note, that we've been discussing is perhaps buying a car. One of the journalists we're working with is even talking about possibly buying a motorcycle. I mean, another concern is we don't want to get trapped inside of the Al Rashid Hotel and be in a sort of de facto prison. We want to be able to have access to hospitals so that we can see what's happening here. We want to have access to ordinary Iraqis so that we can get their stories out. We don't want to be trapped somewhere. And so we're constantly in a process of debate which hotel to stay in, which part of the city to stay in. Like Iraqis, we are people too. You know, we're not simply robotic journalists. And so we're constantly having conversations also about safety. We're personally stockpiling goods as well and trying to pool our resources. In fact, along with Jackie Suen, who I'm working with from Big Noise Films, and Thorne Anderson, an independent photographer, the three of us have sort of formed our own affinity group, and we've elected to take responsibility for each other in the event of a war. And I think that's really the only way that you can proceed in a situation like this. You can't think that you're going to be by yourself and be okay. You depend on your brothers and sisters to sort of keep you sane in these situations.
Jeremy Scahill, talking to us from Baghdad. Thank you for joining us on this national teach-in on Pacifica Radio Against the War.
Thank you, Dennis.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio. We now go from Baghdad to the Washington, D.C. area, where we're joined by Anas Shalal. He's an Iraqi businessman and the founder of the Mesopotamia Cultural Society and of a new Iraqi-American peace group. Anas Shalal, welcome to Pacifica Radio.
Thank you very much, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you. I know that many Iraqi-Americans are very troubled by what's going on now, and they're terrified about what might happen to their relatives. Have you been communicating to your aunts, uncles, brothers, sisters, relatives on the ground?
We have been. I have a couple of aunts that we stay in touch with. My mother calls them on a regular basis, and their mood goes anywhere from panic to denial. As Jeremy very ably reported, the people are quite upset. Many of them that are able to leave Baghdad and go in more rural areas in order to avert an attack on the capital, as they're hearing would happen.
Have you spoken to any of your own relatives, and what are the kinds of things you're hearing?
Well, for some of my relatives that have places outside of Baghdad, they are moving there for the time being, hoping that they would be spared. For others, they have, you know, very large extended families, and it's very difficult for them to just pick up and go without everyone else. And remember, you know, Iraq is a fairly advanced society. They have jobs, and they work, and they, you know, they have to go about their regular lives. They can't just put everything on hold and just wait for whatever might happen. They have no idea.
Well, now, talk a little bit about your society, Mesopotamian Cultural Society, not about the society, but the bombing of the cradle of the civilization, if you will. What kinds of destruction has already occurred, and what is in danger now?
Well, I think, you know, if you talk to any of the so-called experts about Iraq, any of them, and you ask him to name one poet, one writer, one musician, just one person of culture from Iraq, they would not be able to. As you have reported many times before, back in 1993, in June of 1993, when Clinton sent that devastating attack on Baghdad of 23 cruise missiles, where eight of them erred and hit the home of Iraq's most prominent living artist at the time, and she was killed, and her daughter ended up being injured and losing an eyesight. Another family member of hers died. This happened in 1993, Layla Al-Attar, as you had reported before, was killed in that attack.
And also, the civilization itself, the museums, everything has been jeopardized or already hit.
Well, I've said this before. I mean, Iraq is the cradle of civilization. It's used to be called Mesopotamia, and literally, if you walk around Baghdad, you're tripping over artifacts, you're tripping over history. Whatever attack happens, wherever a bomb is, is dropped, it's bound to destroy some major part of civilization.
And finally, you've founded a new Iraqi-American peace group. Apparently, the Bush administration isn't interested in talking to you. In 1 minute, I'd like you to talk about that. But first, please talk about the Iraqis that Bush is dealing with and that the CIA are now manipulating.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. The Iraqi National Congress and the Iraqi National Front has been very active in sort of giving information to the Bush administration about how to proceed with this war, and they've been very, very active in making sure that the sanctions remain on Iraq and the Iraqi people. I find this very disturbing in that maybe some of them even have relatives that live there, and yet they feel that having the sanctions are a price worth paying, as in the words of Madeleine Albright back in the late 90s. But it's very disheartening to look at this group, and most of them, in fact, without exception, have absolutely no support on the ground in Iraq. They're exiles. They have other interests in making sure that they get some position in the new government or be able to procure some of the very lucrative contracts that are bound to come out once Iraq is destroyed. I think they sort of got a taste of what the Bush administration has in mind in this past couple of weeks, where the Bush administration had come out and sort of outlined what a post-Iraq regime would look like, with General Tommy Franks in the lead, and replacing the top two tier of every ministry with American either generals or American employees, and making sure that the Iraqi National Congress and those other groups are relegated to nothing more than an advisory position. And I think they're pretty upset. In fact, one of them said something along the lines, "I feel like we're being used."
Well, typically, you can expect the CIA to be dealing with some pretty strange characters. Some of them actually have a serious criminal problem. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, the head of the Iraqi National Congress, Ahmed El-Chalabi, was tried and convicted of embezzlement in Jordan. He had to be smuggled out of the country in the back of a car and be taken out to London. I think Jordan has since sort of rescinded that indictment in favor of the United States interests, and it's fascinating to see how we tend to do our foreign policy here by removing one brutal dictator, replacing him with another shady character.
In 30 seconds, tell us about the new peace group.
The peace group that we started, Iraqi Americans for Peaceful Alternatives, it really is an alternative to the other groups that are here, the Iraqi National Congress and other groups that don't represent the Iraqi people and really represent just themselves. We felt that most Iraqi Americans feel that a peaceful alternative is what they are seeking, what they want. They want to see their families when they go back. They want to be able to visit Iraq openly, and they want to allow the Bush administration, other administrations to come, to be able to resolve this issue in a peaceful way as they know it can be.
All right, I want to thank you very much, Anas Chanel. He is an Iraqi-American businessman, founder of the Mesopotamia Cultural Society and of a new Iraqi peace group. Thanks for being with us on this national special, this teach-in against the potential war against Iraq and about U.S. and world resistance to that. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Dennis.
Well, and one more person we spoke to just before airtime was Tony Benn. He's the longest-serving British parliamentarian. He's just back from an interview with Saddam Hussein, and he confronts some of the myths and realities of this war. Tony Benn is right here.
Well, if you take the humanitarian argument first of all, I mean, take Saudi Arabia, which is a close ally of the United States. There's no democracy there whatever. No elections at all. There's the royal family who govern the country, and I've been to Riyadh, and in the main square, they call Chop Square in Riyadh, every so often women have their heads cut off for adultery and men have their hands cut off for theft. Now, why is it that the concern for human rights should be so tightly focused on Iraq and not on Saudi Arabia? The reason is Saudi Arabia is a friendly regime supplying the oil the United States wants. Then you have to look at Iraq and say, well, it is a bit puzzling because Saddam Hussein was one of the closest allies of the United States. Donald Rumsfeld went to Baghdad in 1983 after chemical weapons had been used against the Kurds at Halabja and against the Iranians. And his visit was signaled in Washington as a breakthrough in relations between Iraq and the United States. And the United States armed Iraq and supported Iraq. At that time, Iraq was very useful because it was fighting Iran. Now, Iran was under the Khomeini following the defeat of the overthrow of the Shah. And the Khomeini was a sort of, well, in some ways you could say he was an al-Qaeda leader, fundamentalist Muslim laws imposed some harshness. So Saddam was popular in Washington. And I think to explain what's happening now, you can't really explain it in terms of long-term American humanitarian concern. There must be some other explanation. And, of course, oil is the one that comes to mind because the Republican leadership in the United States has got a lot of experience and interest in oil, and there is a lot of oil in Iraq, and the world needs oil, and so I think that interpretation, which is very, very widely shared, I might add, in Europe and the rest of the world, and I thought quite a number of people in the United States understood it very clearly, is thought to be a major factor. I don't personally think it is about weapons of mass destruction. And certainly not about al-Qaeda, because historically Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athist Party detest the al-Qaeda because they are rather like the Khomeini whom they fought a few years ago. So if you try and piece the bits of the jigsaw puzzle together, there is a big gap in the picture that fits exactly the argument that oil is a consideration. Some scientists are afraid that if they go to Cyprus to be interviewed, they may be told, if you don't give us this and that that we want to know, we'll put you down as a war criminal and frighten them. And the other fear they had was that, as in Afghanistan, they might be bribed, because you will know that during the Afghan war, the warlords were bought over to the American side by taking truckloads of dollars. And one or two of the scientists apparently thought, if we go to Cyprus, we'll be given American passports for ourselves and our families and $1 million, and that wouldn't be right either. But both these problems seem to have been dealt with in the last couple of days when the Blix has been back in Baghdad. And I got the feeling that Saddam is prepared to help in any way he can, but whatever he does, they'll raise the stakes higher. Because Bush in September demanded the inspectors went back, thinking Iraq would refuse. When Iraq accepted, I mean, the president's messages recently have been that the inspectors are an obstacle to the war. Get them out. They're no use. So I think that's given the Iraqis the impression that it is never a particular demand that is the justification for the war, but a determination for other reasons to take control of Iraq and the oil and its position in the Middle East.
And that was Tony Benn, British parliamentarian. I'm Dennis Bernstein. This is a national special on Pacifica Radio. I produce a show called Flashpoints. It's on in California and Texas. And we thought it would be very important to continue to expand our knowledge, even as the mainstream media refuses to deal with the real issues behind the politics of Washington, D.C. We're going to continue our discussion. We have an in-studio live audience and a panel. And we're going to tell you who we have to continue this discussion, and we're going to just keep going. On the telephone, we have from Paris, Diana Johnstone. She's a highly regarded journalist who has covered human rights issues in Eastern and Western Europe and has reported for newspapers and journals in Europe and the United States. She's also written a couple of books. She can tell you about that in one moment. She's in Paris. Also standing by is Andrea Zumach. He's a German journalist based in Geneva. He's in Berlin today. He broke the story about the U.S. hijacking the document by the weapons inspectors in Iraq and removing the list of U.S. complicit corporations before it went to the United States. In studio, we are delighted to have Joel Bain, and he's a professor of Middle Eastern history at Stanford University. He's a prolific author and Middle East expert specializing in Arab-Israeli conflict and the history of the modern Middle East. And also in studio is Lamise Andoni. She's an independent Arab journalist who covered the Middle East for two decades for a number of newspapers. During the first Gulf War, she was in Baghdad reporting for the Financial Times of London and the Christian Science Monitor. And she's been teaching here at the UC Berkeley, The War on Terrorism. Let's go first to Paris. And Diana Johnstone, are you with us, Diana?
Yes, I am indeed.
It's delightful to have you with us. What was the mood on the streets in Paris and in France today?
Well, it was lovely. It was really very, very good. It's the largest demonstration I've seen in Paris for quite a long time. The figure is a few hundred thousand. I'm not sure, but the mood was excellent. The streets were really packed. It was hard to move around. And one thing I would do want to emphasize is the very large very large American contingent in the demonstration, and no anti-Americanism whatsoever. There's been a lot of hype in the U.S. press by the columnists whose job it seems to be to work up patriotic fervor in the United States that the French are anti-American, and I just really have to insist that is so ridiculous. What one slogan that I noticed that I would like to repeat, USA, we love you, listen to us, which I think is a pretty good summary of the general attitude. The French are really like Americans, and they don't consider that Bush is exactly the type they like the most, but they would like to wake people up, you see, to the lies and so on.
Diana, let me jump in here. The French Foreign Minister, Dominique de Villepin, got an unusual, if not unprecedented, applause in the United Nations when he said, among other things, that the UN is supposed to be a tool for peace, not war. He also said the use of force against Iraq is not justified today. There is an alternative to war, and that is to disarm Iraq through inspections. Would you say he was representing the people of France?
Oh, not only of France, the world. Something very strange has happened. I would like to talk about that. I heard that speech. I said it was a beautiful speech, actually. I must say that when France first worked on this resolution 1441, which is ambiguous in some ways, a lot of us thought that this was just a way of sort of pretending to be for peace, and that eventually France would back down and go along with the war in order not to be left out of the war. But what has happened is that partly because of the very vicious response from U.S. leaders, notably Rumsfeld, the French government has found itself in the lead of a groundswell of public opinion around the world, in Europe and so today in the demonstration in Rome, a lot of Italians were saying hooray for France, because they, of course, there were over a million people in Rome. Berlusconi has endorsed the Bush policy. It's very interesting to notice that those European governments that have supported Bush to be part of what they like to call the new Europe. What is new about that Europe is that they pay no attention whatsoever to their public opinion.
Well, Diana,
all over Europe is 80%, 90% against this war.
Well, stand by. Let's go to Germany and Berlin, where Andreas Zumach is standing by. Andreas, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Dennis. Hi, good afternoon.
Well, the press is reporting that 500,000 people were in the streets in Berlin, in Germany. What's your estimate? What's the mood there?
Well, it's correct, the figure of 500,000. It was the biggest demonstration ever in Berlin since the end of the Nazi regime, and it was the biggest demonstration in Germany since the 500,000 people that marched back in 1982 against the new nuclear missiles President Reagan wanted to put into Germany and other European countries. And I remember Diane Johnson being with me there covering this. The mood was a somewhat optimistic one, that this groundswell of public protest in Europe might at least put a brake on the dynamics leading to war. You probably or might not have told your listeners the other figures, which are even more important because they come from those capitals where the government